Blog Talk Radio.
I have reason to believe that my son was killed by the military.
Where'd you hear that?
I do not think that they would dare do a thing like that unless an American official co-signed a kill order.
Don't you think that's a hell of a statement, especially considering we're here to protect American citizens?
Mr. Horman, this mission has done everything humanly possible to locate your son.
I think you knew he was dead from the start.
If we knew, why wouldn't we tell you?
I don't know that, but I'm going to find out.
Why would we want him dead?
Probably because he knew of our involvement in the coup.
We're not involved, Mr. Horman.
Oh.
Our position has been completely neutral.
That is a bald-faced lie. How can you say a thing like that when you have army colonels, you have naval engineers, they're all over Viña del Mar?
Please, sit down. Look, it's very obvious that you're harboring some misconception regarding our role here.
What is your role here? Besides endorsing a regime that murders thousands of human beings?
Let's level with each other, sir. If you hadn't been personally involved in this unfortunate incident, you'd be sitting at home, complacent, and more or less oblivious to all this. This mission is pledged to protect American interests.
Our interests. Well, they're not mine.
There are over 3,000 U.S. firms doing business down here, and those are American interests. In other words, your interest. I'm concerned with the preservation of a way of life.
I don't know what happened to your kid, Ed. But I understand he was a bit of a snoop. He poked his nose around in a lot of dangerous places where he really didn't belong. Now, suppose I went up to your town, New York, and I started messing around with the mafia. I wind up dead in the East River. And my wife, or my father, complains to the police because they didn't protect me. They really wouldn't have much of a case, would they? You play with fire, you get burned.
I will absolve anyone, everyone, of everything. I just want my boy back.
Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull.
You will help us find it.
And The Happening.
There are forces at work beyond our understanding.
Yeah, those are the three DVD releases that we'll be reviewing on tonight's show. In addition, we'll also be speaking to writer-director Shelley Ryan about her new film, Jake's Closet. This is Movie Geeks United. It's going to be a great show tonight. Thanks for joining us, everyone. How are you doing, Jerry?
I'm doing fine. Welcome to the show, everyone. Yeah, this is quite a lineup we have. This is really quite, Mr. Darvis, Spielberg, and Shalom, and Jake's Closet. I mean, that's packed. No, I don't mean that in the usual Eddie Haskell. My Eddie Haskell tone. No, I mean, this is quite a
it's
really
diverse.
Think about it, the talent involved tonight is mind blowing.
Yeah, it's a diverse lineup. I doubt any other show on the planet has this lineup of of people here.
You brought back a rush of flashbacks with that clip that you played.
Yeah.
I haven't seen this film in a long time. I know you've watched it very recently, but I haven't seen it in a while. But you brought back a rush of flashbacks with that.
It's such a great film. I remember seeing it probably when you saw it, and of course I was a young teen when I first saw it, and possibly couldn't appreciate it as much as I do certainly as an adult watching it. But I checked this out a couple of weeks ago, and amazing.
I think it's just it seems like, especially today, it's pretty much current. Just the themes and everything presented in it. As are most of Costa Garvis' films, because I think the first films I saw by him were actually Betrayed and Music Box, and I went and rented this. And,
mm-hmm.
yeah, I mean, you know, Really good stuff. Great stuff.
Yeah, Costa Gavras is a very interesting and important filmmaker in that he seems to have this patent down where he can make very politically charged statement movies, but he never loses sight of the humanism in them, and he always makes them thrilling and entertaining. And it doesn't seem false. You know, it doesn't seem like he's imposing the thriller genre on it, you know?
Yeah, not at all. I mean, he's got it all.
Yeah, he really does. And I remember, speaking of his previous movies, I remember being very taken by Music Box, especially, and written by Joe Esterhaus, of all people.
Yeah, isn't it amazing? Like, in the early days, he wrote these really politically charged movies.
Yeah, yeah. Music Box, and then he went off and he did Showgirls Box.
Yeah, no, he has a new book out, actually.
Sorry.
He has a brand new book.
He's got to be a fascinating guy. But anyway, but that was a sensational script, and it had very like dynamic, provocative themes in it, as do all of his films, and possibly none more so than Missing, because Missing was made at a time when this was very raw and extremely controversial. To give you guys a little sense out there of what the movie's about, it's basically, in a thinly veiled way, it's about the Chilean coup of 1973, which the U.S. backed, and that coup cost countless lives. Many American citizens were also perished because they were caught in the middle. But the most high profile of these was probably Charles Horman, and he was a journalist who lived in that region with his wife Joyce, and he snooped around. He wanted the story, and he came up missing. And they Joyce went to the U.S. Embassy and fought for some cooperation. Finally, his Charles's father Ed Horman, who was this very conservative guy, very pro his country and the activities of his government, went over there to help find him, thinking that he was just off somewhere being foolish, possibly. They didn't see eye to eye politically, obviously. And he and Joyce kind of really bonded during this time as they attempted to find Charles. Which, as the movie accounts, they did eventually, at the conclusion of the film, and unfortunately he perished, or so they thought. I think in just this decade, they've done DNA tests, and they've discovered that it wasn't his body that they found. So he's still out there missing.
Right, wow.
Okay. Yeah. This took place in 1973. The film came out in 1982. Still very fresh story that had not been handled, certainly not by big Hollywood. And they had to shoot it pretty much in secret. They didn't want any kind of press on it or scrutiny on the shooting of it. They shot it in Mexico. And it truly is an amazing film. Criterion, I'm sure the timing of this release is, like you said, it appeals to some themes of today.
Right.
So I'm sure it was in their mind to do it for this time. And as you, I think this is one of the top Criterion releases, actually. The extras in this film, you have recent, brand new video interviews with Costa Gavras, who is very candid, very informative. You have Joyce Horman, the widow of Charles, who goes step by step through her process of fighting with the embassy, their lack of empathy for her plight and for her missing husband. You have the producers, and the producers are real heroes in this too, because it's a big studio. I think it was Universal released it, and they really stood by this.
Yeah, it was
film.
Universal.
Yeah, they believed in the story, and knowing that they catch a lot of heck for it. one of the officials at the U.S. Embassy that is portrayed, not by name, but his presence is there in the film. He actually sued, filed a $150 million lawsuit, defamation and that sort of thing, and it was tossed out. And even Costa Gavras says that it was tossed out because Lou Wasserman, the head of Universal, fought for it, fought for the film, and said, mm-hmm. we're not going to back down. This film is too important. So it, you get a sense watching it that this really meant something to everyone involved in the film. It was a passion project, big time. And also it's adapted from a novel called The Execution of Charles Horman by Thomas Hauser, and he participates in the extras as well. And this film won the Palme d'Or in 1982, and it was also it also won the Academy Award for Adapted Screenplay, and it was nominated for Best Actor for Jack Lemmon and Best Actress for Sissy Spacek and for Best Picture. And there's a fascinating thing on this thing from the Cannes Film Festival in 1982. It's a sit-down with Costa and Jack Lemmon and the real Ed Horman, who Jack Lemmon plays in the film.
Right.
And the real Joyce Horman. So it's very, you see this father standing next to sitting next to Jack Lemmon, and obviously he's lost his boy. And then you see Jack Lemmon there, and there's such a compassionate kind of camaraderie between them. We've talked about Missing, actually, when we interviewed Chris Lemmon.
Yeah, we did.
Yeah. And he said that he was always moved by Missing because his father based that character's journey on what if I lost my son Chris.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
You know, and so that makes that movie mean extra, be extra special for him. There's a video interview with several other people about the Chilean coup, where they examined declassified documents concerning the coup, which it's out in the open that it was a U.S.-backed coup. It's not that much of a secret anymore that they uncovered in these files. And then there was a charity event honoring Missing. It happened in 2002 on the 20th year anniversary to benefit the Charles Horman Truth Project.
Mm-hmm.
And all the actors and the filmmakers were there, and Gabriel Byrne was there, and he kind of emceed the event, and he said Missing was the film that made him want to be an artist, that made him want to be an actor.
Wow, okay.
And he said he walked out of it, and he was just, it was like an epiphany for him.
Let me ask you this, going back to the people that they interviewed about the coup, I must ask, is Christopher Hitchens at all interviewed anywhere on this?
No.
Okay, because he's an expert on this, because he always likes to give it to Henry Kissinger, who he associates with this, for backing the coup.
I was just
curious, because he knows a lot. That's what the documentary, The Trials of Henry Kissinger, deals with that in some regard. So I was just curious if Hitchens, they managed to nab him for an interview at all, because he knows a lot about this period of time.
No, he's not there.
Okay.
But, you know, it does have some very astute experts speaking about the case and about the coup.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And a beautiful booklet with a beautiful essay and letters of the Horman family from the Horman family friend, and a written interview with Costa, and the U.S. State Department's official response to the film, which of course said that it was negligent and not factual and fantasy.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah. This was a big deal, and there was a big must-see feel for it as well in the States, so it did fairly well, and I think it's one of the bright shining spots in Lemon's legacy. It has great, the performances are great.
Yeah, I mean, you get everyone's in it. Sissy Spacek, Lemon, I mean, you got a great cast here. You also have Lemon, who's doing a lot of, you have the China Syndrome around this time, a couple of years before this. I mean, he's doing like really some of his best serious work. Save the Tigers, obviously, a couple much earlier than this, but still, I mean, just doing incredible stuff.
Yeah, I mean, we know Lemon from the comedies, of course, but he was in his dramatic work. He very much used that everyman persona
mm-hmm.
to really make statements, to shine lights on different issues. And the China Syndrome is a perfect example, and
right.
You couldn't get a more perfect example than this. And I think the thing that he was attracted to wasn't necessarily the theme of the film, of course he was, but as much as that that journey of a father losing
right.
his son. And at the same time, dramatically during the course of this, he gains his son because he begins to see through his son's eyes and really understand who his son was, somebody that he more than likely brushed off, even though he loved him, as a liberal, a kooky, doing kooky liberal kind of things. But he really began to understand and respect his son during this journey.
Right.
So it's very moving on a variety of levels. I think it's an important film, and it's I was
without
very
a doubt.
Yeah, I was very taken by it. And I think it's one of the best Criterion releases. It just came out. So it just came out yesterday. It's available in stores
yeah.
now.
Mm-hmm.
If you click on the icon there on our homepage, it'll take you to Amazon where you can purchase the film. We highly recommend it.
Yes.
Thumbs up.
Big thumbs up. I think it's that's the big thumbs up of the night.
Yeah, yeah. Costa, what has he been doing lately?
Well, in 2003, or I guess it's really a 2002 release, he made a movie called Amen, which is about the Vatican helping the Nazi war criminals go to South America. And I saw that in a theater, actually. It was a very limited release. I saw it while living out in Los Angeles. It's a superb film.
Yeah.
Excellent. It just shows you he lost none of his gusto, his bravery from Z, which was a long time ago. And it says that the Vatican helped. There's a doctor who's supposed to be like the Dr. Mengele escape to South America.
Mm.
And that's one of the things. But it's about the Nazis, about this guy. They invented the used the Cyclone B gas in the camps. But it's a riveting political film. And the last thing he did was a movie called The Axe, which is a sort of a different film for him. That's which I don't think has come out, actually gotten a stateside release, but it's based on a Donald Westlake novel. And that's all I know about it. It has not really been officially released in this country. I don't know what the status is. And I guess before that he did Mad City with Hoffman and Travolta.
He's done a couple of American films.
Mm-hmm.
Missing was his first, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And he did Betrayed, the KKK
Music
movie,
Bob.
Deborah Winger, yeah, and Mad City on the Medium.
Yeah.
Essentially a statement on the Medium. So he's always topical.
Mm-hmm. Yes, he is.
And he gets there by investing in the characters. So he's an important filmmaker and still very much active. And we need his voice. There's so many kind of homogenized political movies, you know, out now.
Yeah, you could say that.
Yeah,
You know, his voice is always welcome. It's just never enough. You know, it's for every film that he's done. There's a huge gap in between Mad City and Amen. But Z is the one that a lot of people know as most famous one.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a great. I finally saw that a long time ago. And yeah, there's Betrayed and Music Box, the American one. There's a lot of other films by him I have not seen, foreign films that I have not seen. I don't even know if they're available like on our region DVDs, but they're great stuff if you get a chance to see them. Never a dull moment.
Yeah, he's a great filmmaker, and he's still provocative, is I guess my point.
Yeah, oh, he's still got it. It's
yeah.
very rare that a director of that caliber who starts off with a fire in the belly and very controversial stays like that. But when you watch something like Amen, which is towards is a later film, and that still has the same kind of thing as Music Box and Missing and Z, that's impressive.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is. So Missing, pick it up. You can click on the icon. You can purchase it right there at a discounted price, I'm sure. Later on the show, we will be discussing Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull and The Happening, focusing on the DVD treatments of those films. We've already reviewed the actual films in length upon their theatrical release.
Yes, we have.
so What comes out this weekend? High School Musical 3. Does The Changeling come out in your area this weekend?
I think it does, but only at one theater, so I think it expands next weekend. I think this weekend, I'll just go out on a limb here and say I think High School Musical 3 is going to be the big winner.
Yeah.
I just don't think you don't need to be like, you know, a rocket scientist to figure that out. That's just going to be enormous.
And the new Saw film opens as well, right?
Yes, a new Saw film. I guess I got to go see because Will wants me to review it. So I guess, do I have to even show up? Can I just assume I know what's going to happen?
Just copy your review from Saw 4.
I know, really. I mean.
Yeah. Speaking of Saw 4, we did interview Lyric Bent last October. It was last Halloween.
God, it's been a year already.
I know, man. It was a Halloween special. And next week we have Darren Lynn Bozeman, who directed Saw 2, 3, and 4, and his new film is called Repo. The full title was Repo: The Genetic Opera. I don't know if they've eliminated the genetic opera part or not, but...
No, I think it is. I think that's the full title. And that's just everything I hear about it is supposed to be really good. So, I mean, everyone who's seen it says it's like nothing they've ever seen before. So I'm very curious. I hope it gets like a wide release. So
yeah,
me check it out.
What was I about to say? The Changeling. I've been reading reviews of this. Obviously, the reviews out of Cannes were pretty stunning, but the new reviews here aren't as impressive.
Yeah, I've noticed that. I think what I've noticed about the ones from the festival was like her performance is very good. Like I think there was mixed reaction on Eastwood's part, but at least at the festival, like Angelina Jolie was getting rave reviews.
Mm-hmm.
So like she's supposedly a shoe-in for an Oscar. I think I may have seen what I think so far is the best female performance.
Which is what?
Kristen Scott Thomas in the French movie. I've Loved You So Long, or I Loved You For So Long, and she's just
me. Love You Long Time.
No, that's what I thought it was at first too. I thought it was a movie about Vietnamese whores, but I was sadly mistaken. But
Jerry,
I'm a horrible man. But you should have seen what I wrote on someone's blog earlier. But we can't repeat that on this show. No, but she's incredible in this. And what a lot of people I don't think a lot of people know about her. Now a lot of people know she's from Four Weddings and a Funeral and English Patient, but she's also a very accomplished actress in the French language.
Huh.
Tell No One, The Valet, and this movie, she's incredible. But I have to say, there's still a couple performances later this year. We got Nicole Kidman in Australia, which is a very strong possibility. Meryl Streep in Doubt. And I think Kate Winslet in Revolutionary Road.
Yes.
So those are things you got to look out for. And plus the Penelope Cruz, I mean, all the actresses in Vicky Cristina Barcelona. So.
Yeah. But yeah, I hope they don't forget that. They usually don't with the Woody Allen film. Don't forget Vicky Cristina. I was seeing an interview with Charlie Rose and Chris Rock the other night, several weeks ago, and they were both raving about how Vicky Cristina is the best movie he's ever done. Chris Rock's a big fan of Woody Allen. He wants his career.
I think, you just think about Chris Rock's last film, I Think I Love My Wife, and that was based on, you know, an Eric Romer movie. Chris Rock, when it comes to movies, is actually very bright, has very good taste.
Yeah.
And I know a lot of people don't at first, you know, are probably, like, stunned by that, but it's really interesting. If you look at what he likes, you're like, wow, that's incredible.
Kristen Scott Thomas is also, she's on Broadway now. She's doing The Seagull. I think she's doing The Seagull.
I think you're right.
With Skarsgård?
Which one?
Stellan
or Peter? I always...
Peter
Skarsgård or Stellan Skarsgård?
Peter.
Peter, okay. It is Pete, okay.
Wow. Yeah. The one that showed us Peter and Kinsey.
Oh, okay, yeah.
That's Peter.
There you go.
Who's great. He's a great actor.
He is.
And apparently she's amazing in it. There's interesting stuff happening on Broadway. It's a great phenomenon. It happens, you know, here and there. goes through these phases where big stars are coming on coming to the Broadway stage, and there seems to be a Mamet revival going on the Broadway stage as well. I mean, you had Glengarry a couple of years ago. That was Alan Alda and Leif Schreiber were in that, and I can't imagine how great they were. Now you have Speed the Plow,
mm-hmm.
which Goldblum just did, overseas of the Old Vic, but now it's Jeremy Piven is doing the production there. They're about to do American Buffalo with Cedric the Entertainer and John Leguizamo. And they're
interesting.
Yeah, yeah. They're mounting an Oleana at the beginning of the year. So there's a Mamet revival going on that's very exciting. Be hard-pressed to find a more quintessential New York playwright than Mamet.
I have to agree with you. You know, I don't...
Yeah.
That's... You're not going to do much better than that.
I know that Pacino, in the early 80s, he originated a Buffalo on stage. And I think he did various incarnations. He did it with Robert Duvall.
Oh, wow.
In London, I think. He did Julius Caesar with John Cazale. He did Julius Caesar in 77 with Cazale, Meryl Streep, and Chris Walken.
Wow, can you imagine watching that? That must have been intense.
Yeah.
Oh, my.
Speaking of Julius Caesar, I mean, Denzel Washington just did an updated Julius Caesar
mm-hmm.
a couple of years ago, too. He returned to the stage, and Julia Roberts made her stage debut as well in 3 Days of Rain, I think was the name of the show.
That's right.
Some good stuff going on. I wish I lived in that area code. The area code where our show is based from.
Yes.
It's confusing
us. Wait, you guys aren't in the Bronx? No.
Yeah. Welcome, everyone, to the chat room, all of you. It seems like a slow night tonight. I guess a lot of people are watching the World Series. Jerry and I are at odds about this World Series, apparently.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't say we're at odds. I'm just rooting for Philly because every one of my family's from Philly, so everyone's excited.
Right.
And
living in the Tampa area, I'm rooting for.
Yeah, I mean,
I'm rooting for Philly as well.
Anything less. But Olivier and Tim are in here, and that's great.
Olivier and Tim, hey guys, how are you guys doing? So High School Musical 3, Saw 5,
and wait a second, and there's a third film that no one's talking about, Pride and Glory, which is like I've been hearing about for years, with Ed Norton and Colin Farrell.
E Weekly loved that movie.
All right.
I read the review today. They say it's a really strong, sturdy genre movie. And it seems to be, just like I kind of thought that We Own the Night was, too.
Yeah, I think they probably deliberately like pushed it back so it wouldn't get mixed up with that one. I noticed they did that also. Remember Before the Devil Knows You're Dead and Cassandra's Dream were supposed to come out at the same time, and it pushed Cassandra's Dream back a couple months. So,
I will probably go see that before anything, Pride and Glory, even though I think that the title's not great.
No, it's not a great title.
Title makes it sound like a football movie, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, I got to tell you something. It's weird because I remember like a couple years ago seeing this title on Netflix. It was listed on Netflix, and that was like 2 years ago. So they were expecting this.
Oh, was it this movie, or was it some kind of BBC?
No. It wasn't a BBC movie. No, it was this movie. And so I know it's been, because I remember seeing a trailer for it a while ago.
They're making the publicity rounds for it now. So.
Yeah, it looks like, of all the things that are actually in wide release, I would have to say that's the most promising one.
Yeah.
But if I was 12, I'd want to go see High School Musical.
If only I was 30 years younger.
But I can't. I never saw the first two, so I think I'd be lost. And judging from the trailer,
you really think you'd be lost?
I think I would be like, what the hell is going on? I mean, because I'm watching the trailer. Like they've been showing a trailer in the movies, and I'm like, My God, what is this, like Degrassi Junior High or something? I don't know. Who are these kids?
It's Grease. It's an updated Grease, man.
I know it is Grease. You're right.
Yeah. And you know, that's good.
No,
good
it's
for
good.
Kids.
It's gonna make Hollywood very happy, and especially Disney very happy. So
good youth entertainment that doesn't have an animated rabbit anywhere in it. I don't have anything against animated rabbits.
Yeah, I was going to say, what did the animated rabbits ever do to you?
Yeah. Later on the show, we'll be joined by DVD Home Entertainment correspondent Aaron Adidias, where we will review the DVD releases of Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull and The Happening. See if we recommend you go out and purchase those as robustly as we do Criterion's Missing. We're very excited about this. Our next guest is on the line, and
cool.
This is a great, great movie we're going to be talking about here. Let me find this here. Take a listen to this.
Mom, why are you crying?
What are you scared of, sweetie?
Where's Dad?
He's at work, baby.
When moms and dads live separately.
It is important for you to know that we both love you. How could you bring that girl here? You're gonna need a better attorney.
What's your mom up to today, Jake?
Has Peter ever hit you?
What's a restraining order?
A restraining order?
I don't want you to hurt us, Peter.
Closet. There's not a monster in your closet, son.
Mommy, please! Open the door!
That's the trailer for Jake's Closet, a sensitive and haunting exploration of the effects of divorce on a young child. Writer-director Shelley Ryan has created a film filled with stunning atmosphere and terrifically authentic performances and truly genuine horrors. Robert Kohler of Daily Variety says, "This suburban horror show that translates familial crisis into zombies living in a bedroom closet maintains a steady dramatic pulse supported by impressive craft and one fine child performance." It is a great pleasure to welcome to the program writer-director Shelley Ryan. Miss Ryan, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for joining us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I really love the film, and I can't wait to delve into it with you. But tell me how your love of film started and who your influences were and when you decided you wanted to be a filmmaker.
Oh, my God. That moment. Oh, okay, maybe the story works or not. But I've always loved film. I studied theater in high school and kind of went on that track early in my adult life.
Right.
And I went and saw at a movie theater, a revival theater, Dog Day Afternoon.
Ooh.
And
there you go.
It was one of those movies that really just kind of opened my eyes, because I grew up during, you know, the 80s, and movies were, you know, like E.T., and everything was so big and kind of melodramatic. And, you know, going back and looking at a movie like Dog Day Afternoon, just kind of, it was like, wow. I'm like, I didn't even know they could make movies like this, you know.
Mm.
So that was a big aha moment for me.
Yeah, that's an amazing movie. And I am Pacino's actually my favorite actor, so I'm a huge Pacino
expert on this show.
but with Dog Day Afternoon, it is one of the few times where I absolutely lose a sense of Pacino. I mean, he's so encapsulated, and you as a viewer are too, in that world. That's an amazing movie, one of the defining movies of that generation. Tell me about this particular project, how the idea began to originate with you.
Well, I, about a year before we made it, I had known that I wanted to make a movie and do my first feature. Mm-hmm. And I had been toying around with different ideas. And I had gone to see another few throwbacks, Repulsion, and some Roman Polanski films at the time. And I was, you know, those kinds of movies really were influencing me while I was watching a girlfriend go through a divorce. Mm-hmm. And at that, you know, I really identified with her son in the situation. Even though she was my friend and she was, you know, talking to me as a girlfriend, the entire time my empathy went with him and what it's like to go through a traumatic experience at that age. So it was kind of a convergence of, you know, what I was looking for and to, you know, the idea of telling a horror story purely from the point of view of a little boy and having it have such weight and relevance at the same time was just irresistible to me.
Yeah.
So,
Was it a difficult process to kind of because there are a few things that are very distinctive about this film, and one of those things is how absolutely committed it is to maintaining the child's point of view, and I'm curious what that process was for you to understand that child and write that journey so well from that child's point of view.
It's interesting because when you're writing, I mean, I wrote the whole script to be shot that way, and the whole story really resonates, you know, through that point of view. So, you know, it was funny when I was giving the script out and getting feedback, and there were different, opinions on it, and something that I think is very, you know, people expected a more conventional approach, or they would give me notes that suggested I give a piece of information that was outside of the child's, realm of seeing. And I was very much a purist about it, that this had to be, you know, only the information that escaped to him, you know,
mm-hmm.
that he's really just seeing these pieces of incidents that are happening that ultimately build up to something that is so major. I'm kind of a believer in structure, and, you know, this first-person point of view at the time was just really, really fascinating to me. I thought if you really want to get into the heart of the character and just know him and him alone, you know, that this was something that I had to try and
mm-hmm.
see how well it worked, how well it brought the audience in, and if they really related to his experience.
Yeah, and I really took that away from the film. Because you really feel that you are in the place of that child, that you're experiencing exactly what he's experiencing. And it also helped that you created such an insular kind of world where everything is taking place within and directly around that house. That's his life, and it gives the movie a great sense of tension and claustrophobia at times. And the movie is just beautifully shot as well. Did you storyboard everything for this film?
Yeah, I storyboarded because we were working on such a limited budget and limited time frames. I prepared pretty aggressively and storyboarded everything. Of course, at the end of the day, you don't get everything you storyboarded.
Right.
You know, we got you know enough. And then, you know, there were certain times when we had to move so fast that we couldn't pay attention to the boards, you know, like in the night scenes and stuff. We were always in threat of losing the kid, is how we called it.
Right,
Anthony
right.
The runoff set, so.
Anthony DeMarco is the name of the little boy that you use for this, and he's remarkable. Tell me about the process of finding the right child and what exact quality were you looking for from them?
We searched for months, and we saw every kid in town that would come in. A couple things I was looking for is that natural quality this kid has to carry an entire movie and every single emotion with it. So there's a lot of things that maybe kids could get away with in other movies where there's side characters, you know, that you couldn't really get away with in this film. So it was really, really important that we cast a really natural actor. And then the second biggest thing for me was stamina. I had the kids come back several times, you know, just to test to see how they would do at a different time, in a different circumstance, you know, what their patience level was like, how they could handle it, because it's a long day. It was 8.5 hours for a day of him working every, you know, for 3 weeks, 6 days a week, which is long for anybody, let alone a six-year-old. And he had to be able to handle that and not kill the production, I guess.
Well, this is an extremely brave project for a couple of reasons, not the least of which is this is your first feature film, and your lead character is a six-year-old boy. So that's a massive task, and I'm wondering if you discovered any kind of secrets of directing children. What's your approach to directing children as opposed to the adult actors?
Well, the truth is that Ant probably got most of my attention on set, and I wish that I was able to give more to the adults, but just casting them and knowing that they were coming in and they prepared and they knew their stuff, you know, made it fairly easy as far as the adults were concerned. With Anthony, we really became a unit, and I guess one of my strategies for dealing with kids would be writing them first. By that, I never gave him a block of dialogue that wouldn't come out of a, you know, a six-year-old's mouth. I never, like, you know, gave him any speeches or anything that was really going to, you know, get into memorization and you know, take him out of being able to just be natural and respond to the moment. So I was pretty aware of that when I was writing the script, hoping that would give me the best chances of trying to get the kind of performance we needed. And then on the set, it was very much a team dynamic. You know, he was amazing because he started out as a kid, and by the time he left after 3 weeks, he was a pro. And I didn't have to talk to him anymore. He just knew, like, you know, I didn't have to say anything ever. He would, you know, he would just go make the adjustment and have the ideas in his head already, and that was a really fun thing, to see.
Yeah, that's a real transformation, I'm sure. What surprised you about directing a feature? Because I know you've done a variety of, correct me if I'm wrong, but a variety of shorts. What surprised you most about your feature film debut?
Gosh, how hard it is. I know everybody says that.
Yeah.
But it's hard from, like, every moment all the way through. And where whatever stage I'm at is probably the one I'm going to tell you is the hardest. So, but it's
stage,
fun. Go ahead.
Is there a stage that you enjoyed the most or that was most kind of revelatory for you?
I think that I'm probably best in the writing stage because it's alone. and, you know, when you're managing a crew and dealing with that many people and have all these new creative, I mean, the collaboration is fantastic. And the movie at the end of the day becomes something all of its own. And that was a big surprise to me, too.
Yeah.
But... You know, so that those are challenges. For somebody who's spent a lot of time writing and, you know, works as an editor, I spend a lot of time alone with the computer, you know, and then you have to take those skills and transfer them to a set where,
right.
you know, you got to talk to actors and crew and be diplomatic, and it's still at the same time be constantly striving to get the best out of the people and to make things happen that, you know, just might not otherwise happen. Every moment is a fight, especially on these low-budget shoots. I mean, I've never worked on a big budget, so. But every single moment was, a fight to get what we needed. So.
You know, writers, directors are very kind of special people, just because of the reason that you just pointed out, because they have to kind of thrive on the solitary nature of sitting there on a blank screen or a blank piece of paper and writing And then, but they also have to be equally adept at the art of collaboration. So that's not a duality that a lot of people are capable of. So you did it beautifully here. Tell me about getting the project off the ground, because we all hear about the biggest struggles of independent filmmaking is getting the funding and getting it put together. Was that a particular struggle for you on this one?
No.
Really?
Getting it. I know that's rare.
That's unheard of.
Well, if I had a private investor before the project was even before we had started. So, I mean, it's a small budget.
Right.
I mean, I would love to have done it, you know, for a lot more. But you know, it was enough money to do what we needed to do, and. So I didn't worry about that aspect of it having to go. I mean, now where I'm at, you know, is having to go out and pitch projects and try to get people to give me money. And it is so, I mean, to me, that is the truly hardest part now.
Yeah.
But it,
yeah.
For this project particularly, you know, there was people who support me who had a vested interest in seeing this film get made.
Yeah, and it's amazing because it looks... I mean, just the look of it is so sensational. It's such a polished piece of work. I mean, you did a beautiful job on it. And I know the critics have pointed this out before, but that stunning opening sequence, which is just this extended kind of, I would imagine, a Steadicam exploring the exterior of the house, and it's an amazing, amazing piece of work. Tell me about your film festival experience, because you've taken this to a few festivals, I'm sure, and I'm wondering what kind of reaction you've received from audiences on this.
It's been great. Mike, you know, you never really know how a film is working until you're in the theater with them. And as much good feedback as you'd be getting, or as much insecurities as you might have, The time when it all comes down is in the theater, and the film festival, you know, where we opened was it's awesome because there's a few scares in there, and there's always there's also a lot of cute lines, and it was the first time like in like 2 years, because by the time I started it and by the time we finished it and went to festival, it had been like a little over 2 years, so it was the first time I really got to see the script again, you know, and
right.
to see all those thoughts, like how they were landing with the audience. And it's exhilarating. It's exhilarating because at the end of the day, people can leave. And the film, you know, it may or may not be somebody's cup of tea, or that it might upset them if it's a little too intense or too much suspense. But at the end of the day, you know that you have them in their seats when they're there, and I had them, and I love that.
Yeah. I would think, too, that when you work on something for so long and you go through the editing, and one of the hardest things to do would be to keep your perspective and look at it with fresh eyes. So watching it with an audience, I would think, would be like almost watching it for a first time. Was that the experience that you had?
Yeah, it was seeing it for the first time, and it was really the first time since I had that I was able to kind of evaluate my writing too. When you see it fully finished and all the way through, okay, that really works. That moment didn't quite ever work the way I had hoped it would, or you know what I mean. You know, for some part of me always feels that you don't really know if something's working until you've given it every opportunity to, and in the finished form. You know, with all the sound design and with all the editing and having the audience there, that's when I really knew, you know, whether something was working. And right, you lose perspective. You have no idea, you know, a year and a half in, like, what you have anymore. It becomes mush.
Yeah.
You just,
you
love it, and you hope, you know, you hope the best for it, you know, but it's hard to see.
And what was that reaction that you wanted to elicit from this film?
You know, I knew I was going after kind of a traditional suspense genre, but I really wanted to get across this experience of the little boy and how traumatic it can be to be a child. And I know with a lot of people that does really come across, you know, whether they like it or don't, you know, it was successful. I'm proud of that.
Yeah, I'm proud of that.
It was, you know, my intention was very successful. What I didn't know, you know, sometimes is that sometimes audiences aren't necessarily want reality in their genre films.
Mm-hmm.
But that didn't kind of matter to me. Like, I know that the genre of the zombie and the horror films, they would go a different way. And this was really meant to be something unique. And, you know, I was very happy at the end of the day to see that the things that I had in mind to accomplish when I was writing it really were being accomplished at the end of the day.
Yeah. And how are you pitching it? How are you marketing it or trying to sell it? How do you describe it genre-wise?
As a suspense film seen through the eyes of a little boy who's watching his family fall apart.
Right.
It's been very difficult from the beginning with this project because of the fact that, you know, especially with distributors, they see something that looks like horror and they want to go and they want to sell it as that. And you know,
right.
I've always been very careful when talking to distributors, like, no, that's not what this film is. This is something, you know, different and unique. And it's a hard thing to do when you're out there on a move with a movie this budget size, it doesn't have stars, and you're trying to tell the distributor how they should market your movie. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's a very difficult position to be in. But, you know, I've tried to, you know, sometimes they really get it, but they still don't know how to market it.
Yeah. It is difficult.
Know, so.
That's a good point because the suspense in the film and the kind of horrific elements in the film, they're also motivated in reality. And so it's got a lot of stuff going on in this movie. So I would think that it would be a difficult film to kind of get people to get a firm grasp on what it is before they go in to see it. Because I wish more people wouldn't have to have something spelled out to them to go see a film. But this is definitely just a wonderful, heartfelt, very effective film. In terms of writing, I want to ask you about this because obviously you're a great writer, and I envy anyone that can write. It's so difficult for so many of us. But are there themes that you find that you continuously go back to, or when you're writing and creating, do you try to change it up as much as you can?
I find that I have a very strong internal drive, as much as I. Sometimes, you know, I think to myself, gosh, I could be rich if I just went and wrote those big concept ideas
right,
the
right.
people are buying, you know. But, yeah, I definitely, what's the word I'm looking for, find that I kind of tend towards themes that are around fear and the nature of fear in people. And for me, Jake's Closet was a movie about the damage that people do when they're ruled by fear. Mm-hmm. And if I could probably look at anything I've ever written and find that same element of what people are when they're really, you know, pressed. So I, you know, I'm always kind of, it's not dark. I don't want to say that I'm dark, but I am very much drawn to how people really are. And I, you know, my feeling about movies is that they tend to work in this literary kind of cinematic, you know, Hollywood world where people talk the way they wouldn't talk in life and things happen in a way that would never happen. And it's not, that's not a human study to me. That's something else. And you know, very much what I'm interested in, is studying human beings for what they really are, and kind of putting light on that, so hopefully that maybe we can look at it and learn something, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, those are the kind of movies that definitely Jerry and I both respond to, you've done it with this one. Tell me about the DVD release. When does it get released, and where can our listeners read more about the film?
We're going to be released October 28th nationwide, and also it's available on my own website, which I'll plug. That's jakescloset.movie.com.
Mm-hmm.
You can also get it on Netflix or Amazon or, you know, Hollywood, Blockbuster, all those places.
It's a good website, too, by the way.
Yeah, it is. It's a very,
it's a very nice website.
Oh, good. My web designer will be thrilled.
Yeah, kudos to your web designer. So October 28th, and actually, if our listeners, whether you're listening live or in the archive, if you click on the cover box art for it on the homepage where you're listening to the show, it'll take you directly to the Amazon page where you can purchase the film yourself. So we're one-stop shopping here on Movie Geeks United. And I highly recommend you do so, because this is a fantastic movie, and it's a great new artist's voice, and it deserves to be seen. And do you have anything upcoming or anything that you're working on right now?
Lots of stuff I'm working on. Nothing I can talk about, really. I wish things were moving faster.
do you get a sense of, when you're writing something, that you like to keep it to yourself until it's ready to be born? Do you understand what I'm saying?
Very much. I mean, I share everything with my husband, who's also a writer.
Right.
So he's the only person who has any sense of the ideas I'm working with. But I just finished another screenplay that I haven't showed anybody yet, because
mm-hmm.
I don't feel that I'm quite done with it. And so yeah, and it's still under my hat.
Yeah, I understand that somehow. the amateur writer that I am, I understand that about that process. Shelley, thank you so much for joining us tonight. And the film's called Jake's Closet. Pick it up October 28th on DVD, jakescloset.movie.com, and you can also purchase it on Amazon from our homepage here. I really appreciate you coming over to speak with us, and you're welcome back anytime in the future.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Shelley. I'll talk to you soon.
Okay, it's a pleasure.
Okay, bye-bye. That's Shelley Ryan, writer-director of Jake's Closet. All right, we're waiting a phone call from our DVD home entertainment correspondent.
All right, we're waiting patiently. All right, cool.
it is a good film, Jake's Closet. It really is, and it's done with a tremendous amount of style and confidence, and it looks like $1 million this film, and it's about something. It's got ideas, and it's exploring something in a very creative, inventive way. And I was thinking about this because our next tribute show in the Spielberg canon is for E.T., and that occurs November 12th. E.T. is also shot from the point of view of a child.
That's right.
I mean, you really, outside of the mother, I think you don't see an adult until 3/4 of the way through the movie.
Mm-hmm.
If you think about it, yeah. And this is kind of the, and also Elliot, so like so many of Spielberg's characters, is a child of divorce.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
This is another kind of darker exploration of that.
Okay.
It's a great film. So once again, click on that link and purchase it for yourself, or go and rent it when it comes out on October 28th. It's well worth seeing. Okay. So we're still awaiting Aaron. And, you know, I think my switchboard is dead.
Oh, no.
Oh, no.
Oh, no. Dude, what is it with your switchboard? I mean,
I don't know. I don't know.
No, it happens to me, too. When I have it open, sometimes the switchboard, too. And it's BTR, so I don't know.
Yeah. Upcoming shows that we have, Darren Lynn Bozeman next week, next Wednesday, that is, and then we'll have Robert Davi, a great actor, on the week following.
Hey, one of the best Bond villains, and also a great villain on the show, Wise Guy, as well. He's really cool. I like him a lot. I actually have something I would like to plug, if that's all right.
To plug something? Can I?
Let me finish
real quick. What we're
okay.
What's upcoming? Now that I'm on the topic, the 12th, our tribute to E.T., where we will speak to Spielberg's biographer once again, Joseph McBride, and cinematographer Alan Davia, who shot both E.T., Color Purple, and Empire of the Sun for Spielberg, and Amblin, like the very first film he did.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Then the week after that, we're going to delve into the 70s and discuss great movies like Five Easy Pieces and Little Big Man and M.A.S.H. and from the year 1970. It's going to be part of a series where we dedicate 10 shows to the decade of the 70s, which a lot of people consider the last great decade in film. I'm very fond of it.
I think everyone is fond of the 70s because they realize the seismic shift in the films and everything. I really do. I think we've tried very hard in some years to recapture that, but... Yeah. It's really just the 70s or where it all came together.
I will share something with our listeners because it's exciting. Meanwhile, I can't get my switchboard back up. So, Aaron, if you're on the line, please hold. Dun, 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 dun. Anyway, somebody major is reviewing our interview request that we submitted today for the 1970s show.
Okay, we'll leave it at that. I don't want to jinx anything, so.
Oh, you think it'll jinx it?
I think it might, so.
I'll only say this is exciting because every time I submit to Al Pacino or another big star like that, I get an automatic no, and I realize that these people are never shown the request. This particular person who is not Pacino is actually being shown the request, which is encouraging.
It's very encouraging.
Yeah, dangle that carrot. All right, I'm trying to upload our switchboard. Go ahead and plug what you need to plug.
A week from this Saturday, November 1st, at the University of Maryland, the Hoff Theater, you are invited to the Halloween Hangover. It is a triple bill of films from our good friends Paul Busetti, Ian Albesky, and Francis Abbey, who we've had on the show many times, these guys, but we're going to have Cannibal Cheerleader Camp, directed by Paul Busetti, Abraham Lincoln, directed by Ian Albesky, and Francis Abbey's Boxing Day, once again, at the Hoff Theater. That's going to be on November 1st. Let me find out what time. I believe, see if I can get an exact date of when this starts. Not date, the exact time for everyone. I believe it is at 8 o'clock. And that's Saturday on November 1st, the day after Halloween, at the University of Maryland at the Hoff Theater. It should be a lot of fun. And you
Abraham
get tickets
Lincoln.
At the door.
Is that actually a movie about Abraham Lincoln?
I think it's a horror film, if I'm not mistaken. Speaking of Abraham Lincoln, Jason O'Brien's in the chat room.
Well, Abraham Lincoln was... No, that was George Washington. That was the honest man. I just wondered how we went from Cannibal Cheerleaders to Abraham Lincoln.
And I have seen Cannibal Cheerleader Camp, and it is a great short film. I think everyone would like it. It's really innovative and a lot of fun to watch. And I know everyone
likes
the film.
What's the date again?
November 1st.
November 1st, okay.
Oh, I've been compared to Lincoln as Jason O'Brien's. Oh, my God.
Aaron, how are you?
Hey, how you doing, fellas?
Hey! It's time for some more DVD reviews.
Yes, it is.
With Aaron and Jamie and Jerry. I wish we had theme music for this segment.
We could
have theme. Boys.
Just play the Halloween montage you created for me. I just want to say that Jamie, because I am so computer illiterate and when it comes to editing, so I always, depending on my show, I always ask Jamie, usually the night before or the morning of my show, hey, can you edit together like a minute and a half little montage for my show? And he always seems to come through. And so last night he did. I had Dean Cundey, cinematographer extraordinaire, on my show, to talk about Halloween in his other credits. And so Jamie edited A Little Thing of Halloween, which basically consisted of brilliantly just all of the best lines, almost all of the best lines by Donald Pleasence.
Yeah, I mean, the entire movie is filled with great Donald Pleasence lines, man.
He left out the greatest line that Donald Pleasence has, but it is a hard line to find on as a soundbite. But the other line
is gone. Yeah.
The evil is gone from here.
Yes.
Which I think we might be saying that line November 5th. Ha ha. That's my political joke for the day.
Keep your fingers crossed. Keep your fingers crossed.
Hey, that's good, man.
Yeah,
that's good. You made me laugh. I speak to you 6 hours a week. That's the first time you made me laugh. All right. Let's get to our DVD reviews. First up is this one right here.
Indy is back, and critics everywhere love the ride.
Reverse! Quick reverse!
Time hails it a nonstop thrill ride adventure. The Crystal Skull delivers.
What just happened?
Go, go, move!
USA Today calls it spectacular.
Come on.
And the Los Angeles Times raves. This is the Indiana Jones we've been waiting for. Indiana Jones, rated PG-13, now playing everywhere.
And Movie Geek United says it's good, but not good.
they would just cut out the "but not good" and just keep "it's good," like they tend to do. All right, to focus on the actual DVD. I mean, we've done so many hours on speaking about the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull film. Let's talk about the DVD quality. I've seen the standard def. You have the Blu-ray. Tell me about the picture on the Blu-ray, the presentation.
The Blu-ray is just spectacular. You know, we're talking about picture quality, so we're not talking about quality of film.
Right.
And so it is pretty remarkable. There is a slight complaints here and there about maybe it being a little too clear in its contrast, in the resolution in the transfer, and that it might not be as film-like as one would hope that a Indiana Jones film would look. And I can see that, but putting that aside, that quibble, it's still quite a remarkable transfer. Object detail is just off the charts. Just the jungle, the big jungle chase scene just looks truly spectacular. The focus, the clarity, just truly remarkable.
Can you get a sense of I know you just probably spoke to that, but the sense of the throwback look of it? I mean, because they really went out of their way to keep it consistent with the
they did go out of the way. But see, here's the thing. Even, you know, and this is something that standard definition or Blu-ray will show up either way, in that the fact that it's Janusz Kaminski doing the photography and not Douglas Slocum, I mean, it as much as they try to recreate it, it still is. The look always is slightly different than the other three, and that's just by nature of Janusz Kaminski. I did have one critic friend point out that he did notice that, at least this was like the first time Kaminski, he stopped with the flare in the camera. And that is true, something that Kaminski really likes.
He loves those, like, extreme shafts of light through windows. I mean, there's a window nearby. He blasts it out.
Although, in fairness to Kaminski, I must say that this whole blasts of light and kind of bathing in sunlight or in bright light, that is truly a Spielberg hallmark, and it's just a matter of each cinematographer that Spielberg has worked with doing their own version of that, be it be it Close Encounters, be it we're going to talk to Alan Davia later on in the coming weeks with his Empire of the Sun and E.T. and be it Dean Cundey and so forth. So that's just a hallmark of Spielberg. And just
it's telling about the. I mean, it fits in line with the subject matter too. But when you think early Spielberg films, they were really so very warm, you know. The sun was as orange as you could get, and his films with Jiminski feel a little colder.
Right.
You know?
I think the one film in Spielberg's early career that had kind of a documentary-like kind of naturalistic lighting scheme, and I guess it probably had to do with budgetary reasons, was Jaws. None of those Spielberg hallmarks that we come to know from Close Encounters on, they're not in Jaws. Jaws is very naturalistic, matter of fact, and actually rather spooky in some scenes. And that's Bill Butler, Chinatown and Patton thing. But as going back to this transfer, it's a terrific transfer, and Blu-ray is just jaw dropping. I cannot stress how exciting the Blu-ray format is. I know the price, particularly in these times, might be a little excessive, but they are coming down. I guarantee you this Christmas they are coming down even more. And of course Black Friday, you know, you'll be able to get them really, really, really good. And so it is a worthy investment.
The extras on this disc are extensive, and even if you weren't as impressed with this film as you had hoped to be, I think if you want to own every Indiana Jones movie, they're what make it. The extras are what makes it worthwhile. Some of these did appear on the website in the weeks and days leading up to the actual release of the film. But these are like, if you play them top to bottom, I mean, this is just a gold mine of material, a feature length basic documentary of its own on the making of this film.
Yeah, the big documentary that's like clocks in like I think at an hour 20 that chronicles the production and some of the post production. I mean, it covers every detail, every facet, and it's broken up into locations. There are six locations that they filmed at, the New Haven and I think Arizona for the Area 51 stuff, and or Nevada, I think.
New Mexico,
New Mexico, and you know other. And
Hawaii.
I'm forgetting all the other,
Hawaii
for the jungles and all that stuff, and so that breaks it up real nicely, and it's just exhaustive. Detail on everything.
Yeah, it really is. And Spielberg, of course, is famous for not doing commentary on his films, but with a extras package like this, it's commentary, though it would be fascinating. It's almost arbitrary because you get so much of a sense of what it took to film this.
Yeah.
Put it together.
So,
purchase or no purchase?
I say purchase, although I guess I say purchase. I think it's a worthy buy. And I speak that as the one person on this panel who's actually a fan of the film. So obviously I do think it's
You really loved it more than the rest of us. Well,
yeah.
I mean, everyone here I think liked it more than Chris. Chris, you know, thought it was like an act against God or something. but I mean, I can't. I'm not gonna lie. I mean, I was disappointed.
I thought
Love
Guru was an act against God, but that's another.
Well, that's a whole different. That's a whole another can of worms, Aaron.
In fact, the fact that the studio has the gall to offer a Blu-ray of Love Guru, but let's move on. But I say you know I have no reservations purchasing this. Yet my one reservation would be that obviously, the other three are going to be coming out on Blu-ray at some point in the near future. My guess is that there will be a Blu-ray box of the Indiana Jones films, and I'm assuming that they're going to offer some kind of rebate if you bought this disc. That would seem to be the fair thing to do. That's what they're doing with some of these upgrades. I know that like the Zodiac DVD that's going to come out in January on Blu-ray is going to have a rebate if you bought the special edition on regular definition.
Right.
So
that's a very good deal to do, especially if we're going into this, if we are in a bad recession. That's a very nice thing to do.
So my guess is that when the inevitable Blu-ray Indiana Jones collection comes out, I'm sure there'll be a rebate, so it'll be worth it even then. So, but to me, this is a flat-out, I recommend purchasing it.
Yeah. If for no other reason, it really shows off your Blu-ray.
Yes, it does. I mean, it's a good test disc. This, of the summer films that have come out on DVD and that are starting to come out and also have been coming out on Blu-ray, this and Speed Racer are really kind of the your demo discs, if you will, for your Blu-ray player.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, we're on to our next film here.
Were we supposed to stop here?
What's going on? You can't just leave us here.
Sir, we lost contact.
With whom?
Everyone.
There appears to be an event happening. It's some kind of attack. First stage is loss of speech.
There.
The second stage is physical disorientation. The third stage is fatal.
Yes, and the film itself sounds like the third stage.
I just want to say, can I just say one thing?
Dude. I mean, this is your time. Go for it.
Say hi to your mother for me.
That's beautiful. All right, M. Night Shyamalan's The Happening, another film that widely disappointed in terms of its content. Fox is coming out with this DVD of it that has a lot of interesting extras. I think Shyamalan actually, I mean, he thinks about these DVDs, doesn't he? I mean, he puts some stuff in stuff into these.
There's a lot of deleted footage, isn't there, on this? A lot of deleted.
He thinks about every aspect of every film, and not just the the story, pre-production, production, post-production, but what also is going to be on the DVD, the Blu-ray, the hologram version. Someone who is that controlling does not think about every aspect of the home entertainment edition of their films.
Right. The extras in the scene, like Jerry said, there are deleted scenes with introductions by Shyamalan. There's quite a few behind-the-scenes featurettes. The titles of these are The Hard Cut, A Day for Night, Elements of a Scene, Visions of the Happening, A Making of. There's a gag reel.
There's a gag reel?
Yeah, there's a gag reel. Personally, I could do without the gag reels, because a lot of these gag reels on these DVDs, you don't know what the heck they're laughing at. They're just cutting to people laughing or breaking up, and you have no idea what's the gaff.
But you know what I've always wanted? I've always wanted the gag reels, and see if y'all agree with me. I've always wanted the gag reels on the movies where a gag reel would seem inappropriate. Like, I would want the gag reel on Dead Man Walking.
Or Schindler's List.
Schindler's List.
Yes.
That would be the gag, the Saving Private Ryan gag reel.
Yeah.
The Gray Zone, basically any Holocaust movie gag.
Yeah, there you would definitely have to have it for those. But what would the gag reel be for The Happening? I mean, like Zoe Deschanel being my agent. Why did he think I wanted to be in this?
Well,
the Passion of the Christ gag reel.
That Aaron would be a classic gag reel.
Keep going, man. the gag reel is just that. It's just it makes it look like this was the most fun film in the world to shoot, isn't it?
It's actually Wahlberg talking in his normal voice.
You can't feel like you're part of it because.
I don't want to say anything about Wahlberg because I'm afraid he might come on the show and insult us and like try to beat the shit out of us.
Hey, that'd be awesome. You know how many hits we'd get with that?
Oh, we'd get enormous. It'd be enormous.
It depends on how many times he hits us.
Yeah.
The featurettes are interesting. There's an interesting extended kind of featurette on how they, when Leguizamo is in the car and it crashed, there's a scene where a car crashes into a tree. Something that seems so kind of pedestrian when you watch it on screen because you're used to seeing all these grandiose effects and seems kind of pedestrian, but the actual planning and the work that goes into creating a stunt like that.
Is there any talk about, you know, because the whole marketing, the biggest marketing aspect of this film was the first R-rated film by M. Night Shyamalan.
Yep.
And so, I mean, is there one extra or featurette that addresses this kind of a, you know, this hard R aspect of it, whether or not he could have gone further or toned it down or whatever?
There's nothing like that.
Nothing addressed them?
I mean, there's just the common sound bites about, you know, this. I want to go all the way with this. And I think this moment where he did go all the way and it was... surprising scene was with the two kids.
Okay, I'll give you that. Yeah, I'll give you that.
Yeah, I couldn't believe he actually did that. The movie's interesting. Everyone seems excited about being in the film, and by all accounts, he's a very collaborative, very relaxed force on the set, Shyamalan. I do think he's a great director. I just don't think that this film worked at
this
all.
Isn't the one. I thought you were going to say you thought he went all the way with Mark Wahlberg talking to the plant.
Right.
I thought that's the scene you were talking about.
No, I want to say, you know, everyone, I remember people talked about that scene, and, you know, the film is a mess, but I want to say that scene in particular is so... brief and so minor that I don't.
You're right, Aaron.
That I never.
I mean, the embarrassing scene along those lines was when he's talking to her and they're in the field or something right after they run away from the wind.
Yeah.
And he's saying there was a girl at a store and he didn't even look at her. He looked at her or something. It's such an awkward kind of exchange, but you can point to the performances being kind of. Really bland.
Mm-hmm. They are.
But the characters are really bland too.
And I think Jamie, you and I both agree that the one performer who like goes in, digs in both hands is Betty Buckley.
Oh yeah. And I do find that outside of the opening 10 or so minutes, the Betty Buckley stuff is sensational. It is what the movie should have been.
Mm-hmm.
No holds barred freak fest. That's like a.
But it's too little, too late when it does.
You can actually watch that segment on its own, and that would even kind of make a good short film. You know, it's so distinctive. And the person that I was watching it with, one of my best friends, I was watching it with this DVD. I mean, he was looking at it and said, is this movie really this bad? But when that scene came up, he responded. He responded in a very positive, this is a crazy kind of no-holds-barred moment here.
It's the one scene where it's turned up to 11, and there actually is a sense of danger. And if the whole film had been done at that breakneck, over the top level, then
it'd be a lot of fun. Yeah,
you'd have a film that it still might not be good, but it'd be kind of so high energy, kind of campy, that it probably would have become a cult item.
Right.
You know.
That
so
being said, I think we all agree that the premise of the film isn't necessarily a bad one.
It's far better than the actual film.
It's established very well. In those opening 10 minutes, I mean, the mood that he sets in those opening minutes is really effective, I found.
Mm-hmm.
And then the lead characters were introduced. Yeah. But in all fairness, I would put those opening 10 minutes against anything that he's done in terms of this foreboding sense of things and the way he envisions it.
I still got to say that while Signs is still my favorite Shyamalan film.
Me too.
But I will say, as far as openings go that he has done, I still think his best opening, you know, foray, you know, big sequence is still Unbreakable.
I have to agree, Aaron, with that. Yeah. I would have to agree.
The Unbreakable setup, and I do like Unbreakable quite a bit.
Yeah.
It's flawed also, but I do think that opening, you know, sequence is really kind of to show you how great that opening is of Unbreakable. I mean, it was basically the trailer. They basically took that opening and made it the trailer for it, and that's why everyone went. And it is interesting to tie it into The Happening that when Shyamalan was doing press for this DVD, he did float out this idea that he is interested again in doing the sequel to Unbreakable.
Mm-hmm. Well, he said it was a trilogy originally.
Yeah.
Before it came out, he said there was going to be an Unbreakable 2 and an Unbreakable 3.
Mm-hmm.
So, who knows?
Unbreakable 2, obviously subtitled Electric Boogaloo.
Featuring the hit song by Tony Braxton, Unbreakable My Heart. All right.
All right, so, there we go.
All right, what a way to end it. So, do we recommend this disc?
It's only for the Shyamalan, devotees. And believe it or not, there are, you know, we can joke all we want about The Happening, but there are people who will defend The Happening, just as there are people who defend Lady in the Water,
mm-hmm.
God help
them. I know several of them, so.
And people who defend The Village, God help them, too. So,
yeah, I just spoke to somebody that defended The Happening.
Yeah, I know a couple.
That's the last
really
time
like
I speak
it.
To them, but yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, if you're a devotee, I think you know you're obviously gonna pick this up. I will say that I have watched the film again, and while it is a bad film or a mess of a film, it is to see a great director do a folly like this. You can't help but just study it and just kind of wonder, well, you know, what is he doing and so forth. You just kind of, you study these follies and just to see where this director's head was at. And
right.
His camera is fine.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like his camera in Lady in the Water was very assured,
mm-hmm.
Where the script was not.
Mm-hmm.
I think his writing is the thing that's really going downhill. So hopefully with this Nickelodeon film, this Avatar that he's doing.
Avatar. I get the feeling that he's not doing drafts like he used to talk about how he would do, four or five drafts of a script before he got it right. I get the feeling, with Lady in the Water and this, and lesser extent The Village, I don't get the feeling he's doing that one last rewrite that
mm-hmm.
I think he would do in the early years. So if he's listening, love your work, Manu. do us all a favor, do one more draft.
Yeah. All right, Aaron, tell us what's coming on some upcoming shows of yours.
Oh well, okay. Well, next Tuesday on the 28th, I will.
I can catch some accompanying music. Go ahead.
I will have Oscar-winning production designer Jack Fisk. On my show, Back by Midnight. That is on Tuesday the 28th, 9 p.m. Eastern, 8 p.m. Central, to talk about the New World Extended Cut DVD. Oscar-winning production designer Jack Fisk has done all the Terrence Malick films, along with Carrie and There Will Be Blood. So that'll be exciting.
He's
and,
legendary. He really
yes,
is legendary.
He is.
And
he
the,
is legendary.
To get some Malick anecdotes, it'll be priceless.
Yeah, and my big show that I'm still planning and guests are still coming in to be determined. I have guests lined up, and I'm still working on more. November 11th and 13th, those are Tuesday and Thursday, 9 p.m. Eastern, 8 p.m. Central, my two-part tribute to The Sopranos, which is coming out.
That'd be awesome.
Which is coming out in a big, complete series box set. Should be quite exciting. Comes in a coffin. No, I'm kidding.
I can't wait to make that intro.
It's lined up so far. I have show director Alan Coulter, who also directed the movie Hollywoodland, and it's several episodes.
Yeah, good director. Some of the best episodes helmed by him, yeah.
I have Frank Vincent, who's going to come on the show.
Oh, awesome.
Billy Batts himself.
Yeah.
And Joseph R. Ganniscoli, better known to fans as Vito Spatafor. So he's going to be on the show to talk about that landmark character, Vito. And got more and more lining up. So that should be exciting. That's November 11th and 13th will be Sopranos Tribute Week on Back by Midnight.
Oh, it sounds good. It's got a lot of good shows there.
Yeah, much more in the works. Much more.
And we will keep you updated. Aaron's show airs every Tuesday and Thursday.
That is correct. Except for tomorrow, taking a night off. But next Tuesday, we'll be back, 9 p.m. Eastern, 8 p.m. Central. Listen to it live or now available on iTunes, keyword Back by Midnight.
That's right. All right. There you go.
Right.
So that's your accompanying music?
That is my accompanying music.
That's very nice. That's very nice if he gets accompanying music there.
I think so too. I think that's great.
May I show
Jerry's
you,
hoping
may
for
I
his
you
own
the,
theme.
I was hoping for my own theme.
May I show you the specials? I felt like saying with that music.
Yes. What floor, please?
We have the veal.
Oh, God. We're a bunch of jokers.
Yeah.
All right.
Good night, everyone.
Good night, Jerry. Good night, everybody. Join us next Wednesday. We got some great shows. Darren Lynn Bozeman next Wednesday. Movies of the 70s in November. Robert Davi and E.T. Tribute. See you guys next time.